All right, welcome to the Michael Slate Show. This is the Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate. We got a very, very good show for you today, all right? And at the back end of the show, we're going to be listening to a couple of audio clips from the nationwide protests on July 15th, the protest that demanded that the Trump-Pence regime must go. Now, this was the beginning of something very new and something that's got to grow. It is growing. It's very new. And when it happened in 19 cities across the country. And in several of those cities, the demonstrations took place right in the face of the fascist forces. And before that, we'll hear from Bob Avakian and Cornel West, a recording of those two, on is there value to voting? Can voting stop fascism? Now, this is an excerpt from Revolution and Religion, The Fight for Emancipation and the Role of Religion, a dialogue between Cornel West and Bob Avakian. And before that, we're going to hear a talk by George Prochnick given at the Refuse Fascism teach-in in April. The theme of the teaching was fascism in America. Can it happen here? Is it happening here? What is the danger that the Trump-Pence government poses? George Prochnick is the author of several books, including The Impossible Exile, Stefan Zweig at the End of the World. His articles have appeared in The New Yorker, The New York Times, Book Forum, and Los Angeles Review of Books, and he is editor-at-large for Cabinet Magazine. But before any of that, I am very pleased to welcome to the show my next guest. He's historian Peter Fritzsche, who's the author of Life and Death in the Third Reich, and Iron Wind, Europe Under Hitler, and one that really knocked me out is Germans into Nazis. And we're talking about how ordinary Germans became supporters of Hitler and the Nazis and complicit in unspeakable horrors. Peter, welcome to the show.
Glad to be here, Michael. Thanks.
Yeah, let's jump right into it, man. Let's talk about how Germany became a fascist country ruled by a brutal dictator for more than 10 years. You know, and it's interesting because when people talk about this, we were talking earlier, when people talk about this, there's references to some kind of trickery that enabled all this to happen. But there actually was, he actually did come in, he did actually win an election that people voted in, right?
Well, he did. And there's two extraordinary events that happened in the early 1930s. One is the meteoric, the huge rise of the votes for Hitler between 1930 and 1933. And in the parliamentary system, he topped out at 37%. In the parliamentary system, coming from nowhere, that's a huge number. And that gave him a kind of democratic legitimacy. Moreover, he had a press empire. He had thousands of supporters. He had paramilitary troops. So he had real political power that was visible to almost all Germans by 1932, 1933. But he didn't have everybody. There are millions of socialists, millions of communists, millions of Catholic voters who are not necessarily for Hitler. But within 100 days of the last election in Germany in March 1933, he had completely dismantled democracy, prohibited all political parties, and was riding a wave of popular enthusiasm that historians today are still trying to understand. It was a grassroots movement. It was not funded by big business. It had its ups and downs, and we have to understand why it went up. But this was definitely a democratic movement for pursuing anti-democratic ends in an extremely resolute way.
Well, tell me this, Peter, because this is, you know, one of the things that's really, I think we really have to dig into, because it's sort of, you know, you can see it happening now in a certain sense on another level, but at this point, but it actually has a lot of potential for repetition here. And the whole point of this popular myth around how Nazi rule of Germany was imposed, you know, you've argued in your books that there was actually a reason why Germans became Nazis.
There is a factor of imposition. You did imprison tens of thousands of socialists and communists in 1933, but this is a popular movement. Nazism was popular because it was different. It wasn't a big business party. It was not associated with middle-class interest groups. And it was not associated in the minds of its voters with socialism, communism, and internationalism. It was a third way that combined, in the minds of Nazi voters, social progressive policies that would invite workers back into the nation, but would also think Germany first. That Germany had been humiliated at the Treaty of Versailles and it needed to gather all its national energies in order to act on the international stage and recover economically. So the name of the Nazi party is NSDAP, and that means National Socialist German Workers' Party. That acronym is basically the explanation for why the Nazis were able to profile themselves as a new and different force, especially in economically bad times, when people were rejecting what they called the system in droves.
Mm-hmm. Now, again, you know, one of the things that really troubled me is when I'm reading this and I'm studying this stuff and reading your books, and I keep thinking there were, in addition to the people who were like really jumping into the Nazis, you know, and loving the Nazis, others remained supportive but actually didn't like, they liked the new society, but they didn't like the Nazis, and that they sort of managed to find some kind of common ground where they became involved in everything that the Nazis were doing on the ground in the country at the time. And this is, you know, this actually means that they accepted a lot of the stuff that was the build-up to, and pretty quickly, the horrendous stuff, the unspeakable stuff that was done by the Nazis.
Yeah, it's a great question. And I make a distinction between Nazis and the Third Reich. And you could love the Third Reich. You could support the National Revolution in 1933, but not necessarily like the Nazis down the block. And in a dictatorship, it's much easier for corrupt, nepotistic local leaders to be quite powerful. And there's no doubt that lots of Germans mistrusted the local brown shirts in the neighborhood. But the big revolution, the National Revolution, as it was called, and the larger project of building a Third Reich, of healing the divisions of German history, of creating a sort of an ethnic consciousness that would make Germany strong again, both inside and outside its borders, that was indeed widely accepted and won increasing assent. Indeed, in 1945, many, many Germans blamed the Nazis for betraying and destroying the Third Reich.
Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with historian Peter Fritschi. And Peter teaches at the University of Illinois Champaign, and we're talking about basically Hitler and how the hell you explain how he came about, the people that came up and supported him, and what it means for the world today. And we're going to get into that in just a minute. Peter, tell me this. There's actually, at the same time as you're talking about all this, you know, there was sort of this point about people themselves turning a blind eye at best and sometimes actually justifying a lot of things, horrendous things that the Nazis ended up doing. And this was especially in relation to, I mean, there were all the other people that they took out along the way, but then it was also to Jewish people. There was sort of in a sense, reading your books, I sort of got a sense of like, there's, okay, but people turned a blind eye to this and sometimes even sort of welcomed it as, you know, necessary. Let's talk about that a little.
Germans had a deep desire for a unified and peaceful and affluent community, but they understood, and this is what the Nazis drove home, and this is the myth that they won. Something happened in 1918 when Germany lost the war. It was betrayed from within, and the only way you're going to get your affluent, peaceable ethnic community is to slay the enemies that betrayed you in 1918. Who exactly those enemies were, people differed. It could be communists, it could be the Jews, it could be someone else. But they understood that there had to be eradication, cleansing, violence, in order to reach the desired community imagined in the golden ages of the past, but also then projected onto the future. So there was a willingness to accept ruthlessness, and a willingness to say, well, we can't have Judeo-Christian morality. We have to think as Germans and determine our actions on the basis of what helps Germany. Never before in modern history have people so identified their individuals with the body of the nation. And thinking like that means if you think in terms of betrayal, if you think in terms of a Germany that somehow was lost but could be regained, then you have to move against the betrayers. You have to move against the treason. That was the communists, and that was the Jews. So there was a lot of people were complicit in accepting Nazi violence. I don't think the Germans would have voted for the Holocaust, but they accepted the exclusion of people who had previously been considered German citizens because they had an ethnic-based idea of the German future. And this proceeded extraordinarily quickly, within weeks of when the Nazis won their last elections, people became experts on the Jewish question. How many percent of Jews should be lawyers, should be doctors? Had Jews proven themselves in World War I? However you framed the question, the Jews were different. And that was the first step, the violent exclusion of people who were otherwise your neighbors. Simply by saying Heil Hitler instead of good day, you changed everyday interactions. And so the exclusion of Jews from German life, what's called the Cold Pogrom, happened as much from below as it did from regime proclamations. And it wasn't necessarily, at first, a brutal violence, but it was the exclusion of your Jewish neighbors from the newly defined German community. And people wanted the Third Reich and therefore were willing to accept, even if they did think that there were what they called excesses, we're willing to accept them because they thought in ethnic terms and the Jews were on the other side.
So that was sort of a level of complicity in it, even if they didn't think that that was it. And in your book, Life and Death in the Third Reich, you talk about how a lot of towns, a lot of cities where Jews would disappear and or they would be people would see them getting on the trains or being trucked out. And then they would rush to get their belongings or, you know, buy their belongings at a local flea market or take over their apartments, which is a level of complicity that is sort of astounding.
It's extraordinary. Now, of course, most people weren't involved in that, but a lot of people were. The fact that Jews were being deported in the fall of 1941 and then again in the spring and summer of 1942 was known. Then, often visibly, the Jews were brought to the train stations via buses or marches or on the streetcars. The apartments were then empty, and auctions were held, and auctions were advertised in the newspapers. And then people, you can read this in the diaries, had to make decisions whether they were going to buy Jewish linens and sleep in them or whether they weren't.
Boy, I tell you. Let's talk about this, and because we're running up on our time, I have two more questions for you, and I wanted to really get into these. There's some chilling comparisons with the current Trump-Pence regime in the U.S., and anybody who's listening to the show has to have thought that well before I just said that. There's a lot of chilling comparisons, and with regard to immigrants and oppressed nationalities, you know, deportations, arrests, demonization, police terror, et cetera. Let's talk about that.
I ask my students when I teach my Holocaust class, we say, why were people not outraged back then? What outrage is happening to us today that our grandchildren will say, why weren't you outraged? And I have two answers when I'm at, you know, answer specifically. One is our huge prison population, which is four times more than our percentage of people in the world, and the willingness to see illegal immigrants and their families being torn apart. This isn't yet a mass movement, but it is happening here in Illinois. They took the guy who owned the Fiesta Cafe from a downstate restaurant and held him there for 6 weeks till there was so much outcry. But this is happening. You go to El Paso, you go to Nogales, you go to the border towns. People are scared. People are being taken because they're presumed to be illegal. And illegal under the new administration means also probably more criminal. And that means you're assigning evil features to a collective group. This is very dangerous. More dangerous is the idea that somehow we lost America, that America was somewhere in the past was great, but it hasn't been, but it could be again. That means your enemies are small in number, but sinister, and you have to get rid of them. If only had we not done these and these and these things, and that creates internal enemies. And that kind of thinking is extremely dangerous, that there was a wholesome America, and now we're going to get it back. And we're going to get it back by eliminating or getting rid of or somehow undoing the harm between then and now.
Mm-hmm.
And does that mean getting rid of civil rights? Does that mean getting rid of simple empathy when we talk about 11-year-old children or 15-year-old children or 17-year-old children who were perhaps not born in this country but belong in it? It's a whole question of how you define belong.
Mm-hmm.
That's what's happening.
Yeah.
And if you change the definition of belonging, you're policing that new border.
Wow. Yes, absolutely. Peter, one more question. When I first approached you about coming onto the show, I wrote to you and told you what I wanted to talk about on this first edition, because you are going to be back in about 2 weeks, I think. But I approached you about it and told you what I wanted to talk about. And you wrote back to me, remember this, no one could save Jews in 1942 in front of the gates of Auschwitz. You could only save those who would later, and at that point unknowingly, be murdered if you accepted refugees in 1938. That is poor, non-English speaking, possibly communist refugees. And that, of course, was unacceptable and not done. Let's talk about that.
It was not done, and you can look at the Acts of Congress. So we all would vote. We would all say, no, no, don't gas people in Auschwitz, of course. The only way you could have saved, you're not saving people from the gates of Auschwitz, you're saving homeless, persecuted, lonely, scared people in 1938 with all of their foibles. They're called refugees, and they could be us.
Mm-hmm.
I was in Syria 10 years ago. I never imagined, could never imagine this. And now, so many millions of the people I, in that country, perhaps people I met, have no home and no future.
All right, Peter, I want to thank you very much for joining us today.
Well, thank you, Michael.
Yeah, and talk to you again in about 2 weeks.
Look forward to it.
Me too, man. All right, you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've just been talking with historian Peter Fritschi, and we've been talking about basically the situation in Nazi Germany and the parallels it has to what's going on here today as well. What happened there? How did that actually happen? It's not a mystery. You can actually uncover the causes of all this and look and compare with what's happening in this country today, what's being done. We're going to take a quick musical break and be right back, so stay tuned.
Oh, the time will come up when the winds will stop and the breeze will cease to be breathing like the stillness in the wind before the hurricane begins, the hour that the ship comes in. And the sea will split and the ships will hit and the sands on the shoreline will be shaking and the tide will sound and the waves will pound and the morning will be a breaking.
All right, that was When the Ship Comes In from Bob Dylan. Now we're going to hear a talk by George Prochnick given at a Refuse Fascism teach-in in April. The theme of the teach-in was fascism in America. Can it happen here? Is it happening here? What is the danger that the Trump-Pence regime poses? George Prochnick is introduced by Sansara Taylor.
Our first speaker, I'm very happy to introduce, is a writer whose articles, poetry, and fiction have appeared in the New York Times, in Book Forum, in the Los Angeles Review of Books, and other journals. He's the editor-at-large for Cabinet Magazine, and his latest book is Stefan Zweig, At the End of the World. He recently wrote an article for The New Yorker entitled, When It's Too Late to Stop Fascism. I'd like to ask you to join me in giving a warm welcome to George Prochnick.
Thanks so much for having me to this event. I'm going to try to give a little historical lens on the threat that we face. And to begin that, I want to read something not by Stefan Zweig, but from Primo Levi, who was an Italian chemist and eventually a survivor of Auschwitz. He wrote a very, one of the greatest memoirs that exists about that experience. And he wrote the following. We must be listened to. Above and beyond our personal experiences, we have collectively witnessed a fundamental, unexpected event. Fundamental precisely because unexpected, not foreseen by anyone. It took place in the teeth of all forecasts. It happened that an entire civilized people followed a buffoon whose figure today inspires laughter. And yet Adolf Hitler was obeyed and his praises were sung right up to the catastrophe. It happened, therefore it can happen again. That is the core of what I have to tell you. I want to come back at some point, I hope someone will ask a question about that idea of the buffoon, because I actually think that's very important in terms of how Trump has been perceived and to an extent how he's been normalized. But Stefan Zweig, The man that I wrote about was a person of enormous affluence and influence, an Austrian Jew who was born at the end of the 19th century, and by the late 1920s was the most widely translated author in the world. A huge bestseller. His films were made into movies. He wrote novels, essays, poetry, libretti, plays. He also grew up in a very wealthy family in Vienna's most privileged district, the first district on the Ringstrasse. This was a person who felt himself absolutely immune to history's, to political's turbulence. And within a very short period of time, within, in fact, less than 10 years from the point at which he was the most widely translated author in the world, Stefan Zweig's books were being burned, and he himself was on the run from not just Hitler, but the overall resurgence of an intense militant nationalism that came about with the ascendancy of fascism. To give just a little background on his exile, because it's germane to the book that he wrote, the memoir that he wrote, that I want to focus on and what I have to say. In 1934, in the winter of 1934, there was a brief civil war in Austria. It's an event that not many people who don't study the period know much about. It took place over just a period of a few weeks, but it effectively gutted the Austrian, the very powerful and very effective Austrian Socialist Party. It was essentially a battle between the socialists and various reactionary forces allied with the then clerico-fascist leader of Austria, someone named Dollfuss, who wasn't himself at that point aligned with Hitler, who was in fact trying to keep Austria from being annexed by Germany, but had his own homegrown version of fascism and felt sufficient pressure from the more reactionary elements in his party that he felt he could no longer allow socialism to exist as a viable movement in Austria. And once he managed to essentially destroy the party by either arresting people or driving them into various forms of exile and killing many hundreds, the road was open for Hitler's annexation of the country in 1938. Stefan Zweig, when that civil war took place, was based in Salzburg, which is just over the border from Germany. He himself had been working for years at that point to promote humanism. He was one of the best known pacifists in the world. He had a home on a hill, in fact, overlooking Salzburg, a very exposed position. Nonetheless, at one point as the war was winding down, his home was searched by the local police for guns. There was a suspicion that he might be hiding arms to be distributed to the socialists. And he knew at that point that if one of the best known pacifists in the world could be accused of harboring a secret weapons cache at the same time that he also was in an incredibly exposed position, that he himself was going to be endangered in no short order. And the very next day, he got on a train and headed to England, which was the first stop in an exile that careened all over the world eventually. He was first in London, then in Bath, England, then in New York, then in Osinek, New York, then in Rio de Janeiro, and then at last in Petropolis, Brazil, just above Rio, about an hour above Rio in the hills, where he killed himself in February of 1942. But the summer before he killed himself, he was just up the Hudson from where those of us in New York City are today, not very far at all. He lived, in fact, about a mile uphill from Sing Sing prison. And I've often thought what it would have been like for him going back and forth on the train from New York City and having the sight of that massive fortress as a reminder of what was happening to his people and to all of Europe at that point in time. While he was in Austria, in Osinek, in that summer of 1942, he wrote at a furious pace the first draft of his autobiography, The World of Yesterday. But it's not a typical memoir. It has almost no intimate personal details of his life. Instead, what he was trying to do was to create a kind of message in the bottle to the future, to give indications about what aspects of civilization needed to be watched because they could pivot into something, some kind of heinous form of totalitarianism, and also to give some index of what might be points of hope, what were aspects of the evolution of Europe that he'd lived through, which if they'd been cultivated might have prevented Hitler's rise. He managed to write literally something like 300 pages in a matter of less than a month. He was writing in this feverish pace. He never left this very, very small, very grim bungalow that he lived in. And it's amazing to think of this man who had been at the center of all sorts of different European movements aimed at promoting humanism, reduced to this very, very contracted existence, almost no social life in this tiny little house in this town that for him was in the middle of nowhere. But I think it gave him a certain fiery clarity, gave his remarks a real passion that it merits revisiting today, because he tried to trace what he had missed. It's a very modest book in many ways. One of the points that he makes right away is that he can't remember when he first heard Hitler's name. He doesn't know where the whole movement associated with Hitler and even preceding Hitler in terms of Italian fascism, where it began to be a real issue. One of the points Zweig makes is that in these periods where there is an intense upsurge of nationalist reactionary elements, there are going to be many little figures, any one of whom might be the one who, from some bizarre confluence of circumstances, ends up being the dictator to watch. And I've thought about this for a number of reasons in terms of what we're seeing today, partly because, horrific as this administration is, we don't know that Trump is the person who is going to really take things all the way over the edge. And I think it behooves all of us to be very vigilant about other figures who may seem absolutely marginal today, but who are garnering some kind of support in some little corner and may ultimately have, if not a charisma, some magnetic message, some way to channel a very dark will amongst the masses.
This is the Michael Slate Show, and we're listening to a talk given by author George Prochnick this April at a teaching called Fascism in America. Can it happen here? Is it happening here? What is the danger that the Trump-Pence government poses? And the teaching was sponsored by Refuse Fascism.
So what does Zweig tell us to watch out for? One thing he says, and he remarks on this long before Hitler, again, was the chancellor of Germany, but when fascism was gaining power. He writes of seeing the little groups of young conscripts to the National Socialist movement moving through town in these beautiful limousines, in very, very fancy cars, trucks, and spanking new uniforms. Very, 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 very well decked out. In other words, they were well financed. And I think it's always good in the old Marxist adage to follow the money. And so one thing with this administration, and it's more, I don't know what the right word is, more virulently activist elements, is to look at what is being funded. He says the second thing to watch out for, and maybe the most important aspect of what we witnessed in this last election, is the power of propaganda, right? And it's not just propaganda to spread a lie, to ignite a frenzy among the core followers. It's also propaganda that can serve to distract and cover up the actions that the administration, that the party is focused on really managing to bring through to fruition. I thought a lot about this issue of distraction in this last campaign, even apart from the message of hate. I think if the planet survives another 100 years, survives this man and his like-minded cohort, I suspect that people will look back on the 2016 election as a real watershed in the distraction of the electorate, partly technologically induced ADD. I mean, there can't have been any campaign before where there could be one outrage after another, which would just seem to evaporate within days, partly because the mainstream media didn't continue covering it, but also because people seemed unable to hold in their heads the jumble of the sheer volume of outrages, but also the sheer volume and barrage of different kinds of information that were being fed through them, through this feed that we seem all too addicted to. There was a remark that really rang through my head from Supreme Court Justice Louis Brandeis, who noted that when the Constitution was being framed in Independence Hall, the authors of that document had the road in front of Independence Hall covered with straw so that the sound of the coach wheels would be muffled and wouldn't disturb their debates, their discussions. And if we think about that level of attention and the absolute diffraction of our minds today, I think we all have to do everything we can to spend time off all devices and really trying to think as hard as we can, to just think about what's going on in the most concentrated way possible. Along with propaganda, the money, and the charismatic leader that in some sense we have to acknowledge Trump is, Zweig makes the point that the Nazi Party was able to introduce its measures as effectively as it did because it took the approach of giving one poison pill at a time. The party didn't try, in other words, to throw everything on at once and just disorient people. There was an effort to see how each new measure would take, and when the European body politic gave sufficient resistance to a measure, they'd back off and wait, and then give another pill. It was one pill at a time until, Zweig writes, people were so inured to the effects of the poison that they were willing essentially to embrace the apocalypse. Finally, on this issue of Trump's character and the idea, which I think resonates very profoundly with what we've seen of the buffoon, I can't tell you how many writers, activists, thinkers of the 1930s wrote about their experience of Hitler initially having been of experience of such a fool that they could not believe that this man should be taken seriously. The son of Thomas Mann, Klaus Mann, who was himself an important writer and progressive thinker, described an experience where he was sitting in a Bavarian tea house at one point, and he realized Hitler was at another table with a few of his henchmen. And he was there consuming these little cakes in this unbelievably boorish manner, stuffing his face. And Mann says that he looked at this man, at this petite bourgeoisie figure, this embodiment of just a kind of vile piggishness, and said, there's nothing to worry about. He can't possibly cause us a problem. Zweig writes about how when Hitler's writings began to be circulated, his sheer inarticulateness, his inability to make an effective argument, to say anything with force, made the intellectuals just dismiss him in exactly the same way. I worry that all of the ways that Trump has shown himself willing to play the fool, to be a clown, to display his intellectual mediocrity, has allowed sometimes for a kind of snarkiness to overtake a real analysis of what he's doing, of all of the little measures on top of the big threats that he makes. I think it's been, however intentionally or not, it doesn't matter, it's been an incredibly effective smokescreen. Everyone has so much to mock that the fact that he does exactly what he says he does, that he has to be taken both seriously and literally, gets lost. In Zweig's memoir, he goes through a whole slew of different stages that darkened the canvas in Europe. And he says, finally, that one thing was still missing. This was after Hitler's ascendancy. He said, even when Hitler became chancellor, people still, and he counts himself among the people, had no notion whatsoever of what was coming. Not a clue. For all that they were aware that they had put in, that Germany had put in power an incredibly dangerous, unpredictable person with incredibly vicious rhetoric, there was not a hint of what was to come. So what was the moment for Zweig that really tipped events into some irretrievable, disastrous abyss? That was the Reichstag fire, the burning of the German parliament building that happened less than 30 days after Hitler became chancellor. This was a fire that there's been speculation may have even been ignited by Nazis, the Nazis themselves. No lives were lost. It was the destruction of a symbolic edifice. But it became the excuse for Hitler to suspend all pretense of due legal process. Everything from that point on became an emergency measure. Of course, it seems to me that we already see signs of Trump looking for that act of terror, either false or actual, exaggerated or not, that gives him the excuse to suspend any kind of judicial responsibility. I worry profoundly about that. And it's one of the reasons that I think, so far from ever allowing this administration to be normalized, it has to be resisted at every single step, in every single executive order has to be protested. There, the minute that an agenda that we know has such an enormous tide of hatred behind it is in any way allowed to become business as usual, I think that the opportunity for bursting out with some massive atrocity that changes the ball game overnight is huge. You know, people are still making a lot of money in this administration, while this administration's in power. That's one of the reasons that the GOP has shown itself so spineless. Until the economics are disrupted, I think it's going to be very, very hard to really get at him. But if people boycott goods, if they block roads, if the people who make Trump possible start feeling this is not working out so well economically, maybe we can avoid that catastrophic last moment. You know, Zweig teaches us that there is, in fact, a window in which it's possible to act. But once that comes down, you're in a whole other reality, and there's no way out. And I hope that all of us do everything in our power to seize this hour now. We do still have the power to act. Things aren't yet set in stone, and it's all of our responsibility to do everything we can to fight. Thank you.
That was George Prochnik, author of The Impossible Exile, Stefan Zweig at the End of the World, and many other works. His articles have appeared in The New Yorker, New York Times Book Forum, and Los Angeles Review of Books, and he is editor-at-large for Cabinet Magazine. We're going to take a quick musical break and be right back, so stay tuned. That was Outer National with Fighting Song, and playing along with Outer National was Tom Morello. Now we're going to hear Bob Avakian, chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, and Cornel West, professor of philosophy and Christian practice at Union Theological Seminary in New York, on Is There Value to Voting? Can Voting Stop Fascism? This is an excerpt from the DVD Revolution and Religion, The Fight for Emancipation and the Role of Religion, a dialogue between Cornel West and Bob Avakian. And you can find the entire dialogue at revcom.us.
Someone asks, in response to voting, is there no value in working to abolish a system while participating to minimalize the immediate damage it does at the same time? And then someone else asked, if we avoid voting because no candidate represents the left, how can we also avoid enabling the rise of the worst of the right?
Now, I think Brother Avakian said it well when he said he's not against fighting for the right to vote, and under certain circumstances, voting might make a difference. He just doesn't want to trot out the illusion that somehow we can vote our way through fundamental social change. I think it was Emma Goldman who used to say, if voting would lead toward fundamental transformation, it would be illegal. So we're not against reform. We fight for reform. We're not seduced by the illusions of reform. That's all. Is that a characterization of what you were talking about?
Yeah, but I think there's another, yes, but I also think there's another point here, which is the logic of the vote of voting forgets one very basic fact, that in any kind of profound social change that's come about, it didn't come about by people playing by the rules and going along with the way things are. It went by people stepping outside of the way things are and refusing to go along with the rules. If you think about, for example, even some of the gains of the civil rights movement, the way things were in the South was, it wasn't just something people, you know, white people didn't want, that black people could go to a restaurant. It was against the law.
That's right.
The law said that you had to have segregation. So if you were gonna change that, you couldn't say we have to abide by the law. You have to say this law is an unjust law. We have to step outside and oppose that. And if you think about any kind of basic change that's been brought about, it's always happened. See, people say, you know, for example, now I got to call his name, Michael Eric Dyson. You know, in the last presidential election, said, well, you know, if you don't vote, then you aren't in the game. You know, the championship is the San Antonio Spurs and the Miami Heat. If you don't support one of those two teams, then you don't have it. You're not involved. You don't have a dog in the fight. The problem is, if the choices that they're giving us are the only way you can play the game, then that ought to tell us that we don't need to be playing this game. See, that's the first thing. And what we need to do, like people have always done whenever they've changed anything in any kind of fundamental way, is to step outside of the rules. Like, let's go back to right now, what's hanging in the air, the Michael Brown thing. How many times have you heard over and over again, well, we have to respect the process. We have to let the system play out. We have to let the system work. But this is the system working. The assassination of Michael Brown and so many others, thousands of others, that is the system working. And, you know, look, how many times going back, say, 50, 60, 70 years, were black people lynched in the South? And thousands of times, and how many times was any white person ever convicted of murdering them in that way? Now you can come forward to the present time. People always say, well, you know, the police have such a dangerous job. You know, look, what about all the police that are killed by black people? Well, what about them? First of all, you can't hardly find any. You go and take the statistics for the number of police that have been killed over the last 30 years and put it up against the number of black youth and brown youth that have been killed by the police, and one of them will be like this and the other one will be like that. And then here's the other thing. If somebody black or brown does kill somebody in the police, how long are they gonna live? And if they live, how long is a grand jury going to take if it even goes to the grand jury, to indict them for murder. Take the list of the number of police that have ever been indicted and tried, let alone convicted, for killing one of these youth, and put it up against the number of youth who've been indicted and convicted and either executed or sent to life in prison for the few times that they have actually killed the police. So if you, this is the setup you're dealing with, and this goes back to elections. The problem with the elections is that the terms are always set by the powers that be, by the system itself, in a way that always makes the choices get worse and worse. So that what yesterday was something that you regarded as an outrage, tomorrow that becomes a compromise position, and the day after that it becomes the best thing you can hope for under this system and by voting. And this is what's wrong with the whole thing of voting. We have to go out and change the terms, not try to find the best we can within the terms.
I think this raises an issue which in some ways is the elephant in the room now, which is very much like the Sinclair Lewis novel. You said what? Oh, you can't hear? What? I can't hear. Oh, hit him where it hit. Well, the economic boycott that we called for in New York just 2 weeks ago, to end stop and frisk and to have the resignation of Bratton. Yeah, economic boycott, yes. But what I was talking about was this, though. Whoever raised their voice like that, it sound good. I think beyond that, we have to come to terms with the fact that there is a real possibility that America could go outright fascist. We got to come to terms with that. And what that means is that when you have politicians who are bought off by big money, bought off by big banks, bought off by big corporations, so that the government itself is completely subsumed under the power of Wall Street and big corporations. And those voices that are raised to try to bring critique to bear are either demonized, character assassination, or literal assassination, America is then very much on the road to fascism. And, well, no. The very fact that we're having this dialogue here is in some sense a possibility of some people speaking their minds. I'm talking about when just to raise your very voice, my dear sister, means you shut down like a dog. We can call it soft fascism versus hard fascism. Okay. So by raising voices, by still having possibility of social movements, even though it's penetrated by the FBI, that's soft fascism. Then you got thick fascism. But I don't want to play with the word fascism because many of us have had to deal with much more harder fascism where we couldn't raise our voices at all. You see? But I'm just saying that because when you look at the three dominant tendencies of neoliberal capitalism, which is financialized, privatized, and militarized, and the financializing with wealth at the top, you're privatizing public education, public life, public prisons across the board, and then you militarize them, beginning with the schools and the airports, let alone the bombs in 890 military units around the world with a ship in every ocean. That is the American empire at the moment. At the moment. And to the degree to which the very possibilities of public spaces where certain voices, let alone certain movements, can still be enacted. Because believe me, under fascism, the Revolutionary Communist Party would not exist at all.
Well,
we
wouldn't be here, sitting here.
Well, we would be underground in a serious way. Now, it might be the case that there's a whole lot of folks underground. But I mean, the point is that I'm just talking about that's one of the elephants in the room in regard to what the challenges are.
Well, I agree. And I think the point, once again, is that there's only one way that's going to be prevented, and that's the same way that everything else we're talking about is going to happen. It's people rising up and refusing go along with it and winning more and more people. Look, we have to go, when we talk about transforming the people, we're talking about, it's not some mystical process, we're talking about transforming the thinking of people, large numbers of people, how people understand the reality out here, what their values are based on that, how they see going about things in the world, what they think is important, how they see the possibility of living a different way, and how they see going about fighting for that. But this is the key thing we have to do. We can't just have a good dialogue, and believe me, I'm enjoying it very much. And it's very important, and we need to do a lot more of this. You and me need to do more of this, and other people need to do more of this. We need to be, our agreements, our disagreements, we need to be wrestling with them. Right. We need to find the unity as broadly as we can, and we need to keep talking about and arguing about our disagreements in a principled and lofty way. But at the same time, we can't just come to a thing and feel good for ourselves. This is not about us. This is not about the people here just unto ourselves.
That's right.
This is about what kind of world we're going to have and what we're really willing to do to actually fight to bring that world into being and to live in a way that's consistent with that and to bring into being a world that we can give to our children and their children that's much different and much better than this world. So we have to go out of here. That's why I said, and I was very serious. I'm not playing here. If they don't bring down an indictment against the murderer of Michael Brown, that is a test for all of us, and that is a test for this society and the people in it. What kind of society are we going to live in? What kind? It's not the only one. There are many tests, but it's one right in front of us right now.
Okay.
And if we're going to prevent, look, if the rulers of this country think that they have to throw off their democratic mask and go to what you're calling thick fascism, go to outright dictatorial rule without any pretense of allowing for the will of the people and rights and protests and so on. If they come to a consensus, maybe through a lot of struggle in their own ranks, but if they come to a consensus that that's what they need, they're going to move in that way, and nothing will stop them but us. And the millions and millions of people who are like us or who are not like us but need to be one to understand the world the way that we're coming to understand it.
Oh, that's real. That's real.
That was Bob Avakian and Cornel West. Is there a value to voting? Can voting stop fascism? This is an excerpt from Revolution and Religion, The Fight for Emancipation and the Role of Religion, a dialogue between Cornel West and Bob Avakian. And believe me, folks, this is a question that you really got to dig into, take up, think about, and act on once you understand what the hell is really going on, all right? Now we're going to hear two short audio clips around the July 15th demonstrations that happened in many cities around the country and were initiated by Refuse Fascism. And these demonstrations were demanding that the Trump-Pence regime must go. The first is a clip from Michelle Shia. She was the MC of the demonstration in Los Angeles, and she's from Refuse Fascism. The second is July 15th, Trump and Pence Must Go, the beginning of something new. These are extremely important to listen to today because things are ratcheting up and people got to be paying attention, all right?
We're going to have a short rally. Again, these people, what are they representing? What are they upholding? When Donald Trump says, make America great again, what is he saying? He's saying make America white again. He wants to go back to the days when there was a separation, where black people had to go use a different bathroom than white people, where they were treated as less than humans. Well, we say no to that, and we're determined to drive out this fascist regime from power, and we're not going to sit back and wait and see. These fascists in the White House have already shown us what they're going to do. They've told us what they're going to do, and we are not going to be those good Germans that just sat back while there was bodies all around them that just covered their eyes and pretended like it wasn't happening. No! We are not going to go back to those days. We refuse to go back to those days. We refuse to be shut down. We refuse these ignorant fools to intimidate us. We're not going to get intimidated. What are you going to intimidate us for? They're here to protect a piece of concrete, for goodness sake. If it wasn't so dangerous, it'd be laughable. But these people are serious. This is how fascism consolidates. Fascism consolidates through these modern-day brown shirts going around and shutting up all opposition while those people in power continue to carry out these genocidal programs against the masses of people. We should not get distracted. We are on a mission to drive out this fascist regime from power, and we are not going to back down off of that.
To all who stood up on July 15th in 18 cities to say, In the name of humanity, we refused to accept a fascist America and did so in several cities in the face of the hateful vitriol and, in one case, violence of the Trump fascist ghouls. We salute you. Hundreds in several major cities took to the streets and raised a unifying demand. The Trump-Pence regime must go. This signifies something new, an organized force proposing a bold plan to demand that an entire regime be removed from power because it is fascist and what that would mean for the future of humanity and the planet. Everyone who stepped out today, everyone who threw their heart into organizing for today should know we have put this demand, the stand, and the organization of RefuseFascism.org on the map. That matters.
Today is the beginning of what must be a new stage of our struggle. There must be no illusions about what we face. We must discuss and debate deeply with one another to come to understand the tremendous necessity we face in confronting a regime in the most powerful country in the world that is hell-bent on consolidating fascism. It is an American fascism, a fascism wrapped in the Bible taken literally and the American flag saturated with racism, misogyny, and xenophobia. Going forward from today, we must shatter the illusion and all the self-delusions that what we face is just another in a long line of bad administrations, or that the checks and balances of this system will prevail and rescue us. Already, in state after state and at the federal level, they are moving to criminalize and eliminate dissent and protest. The rights and the dignity of the people have no place in the program or the coarsened heart of this regime. No, we must transform our resistance to become something far more serious, a struggle that can alter the course of history, driving out a regime that imperils us all.
We refuse
to accept
a fascist America.
All right, that brings us to the end of yet another show. I want to thank all of my guests. I'd like to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson, my production assistant, Jeff Pryor, my engineer, Kiana Williams, and all of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. Once again, that's mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. We're going to go out now with what has become one of my favorite songs, The Voice of Revolution from Savage Rose. Talk to you again next week.